Welcome to the podcast of Thousand Harbors Zen, featuring talks with Cohen France. This podcast is made possible by generous donations from our listeners. To contribute or to learn more about our community, please visit thousandharborszen.com.
The man who first taught me to do Zazen was my high school English teacher. His name was David Cooper. And when I was in his class, junior year, before he and I ever talked about Buddhism, one of the stories that he introduced us all to was one by Ursula Le Guin, who was a favorite writer of his. And the story, many of you have probably read it, it's called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And if you have heard it, forgive me, I'll give a very short version of it. And I actually haven't read it for a long time, but the feeling of it is seared into my memory. Much of the story is a description of this city called Omelas that is a utopia. It's perfect. Everyone is happy, and the way I remember it, the weather is always good, and there's always a parade, and it's always peaceful. No one wants for anything. It is paradise. People live there with a constant feeling of safety and friendliness and joy. And after we've heard this description of this city, there's a reveal, which is that through mechanisms that aren't made understandable to us, there's an arrangement by which all this joy and prosperity and peace is upheld. And that is that beneath the city there's a room, and in that room there is a child. And that child is completely unloved intentionally. That's the rule. You cannot speak to the child. You cannot show the child any affection. You cannot look at this child with kindness in your eyes. And again, though we don't understand how this works, everyone agrees that if you just do this, if you just allow this one thing, everything else will be just right. Again, the title is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. Because Le Guin tells us that occasionally, a resident of this place will just stand up and start to walk away. They can't be a part of this bargain anymore. Even if it means giving up everything that they have, they can't hold that burden any longer. And so there is this phenomenon of people who just leave. It's a very powerful story. I've been thinking about it recently, and I've also been thinking a lot about the four vows. Recently, our community has become even more centrally focused on these four vows. They've become a part of our daily practice in a way that they weren't. We sit every day, and at the end, we just say the vows. And that's how we close, and it's how we begin our day. For me, every morning, those are the first words that I speak to anyone. And here, in part because of the logistics of ceremonies in Zoom, which are not great, we've reduced our liturgy to this essence of the four vows. Beings are countless. I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to put an end to them. Dharma gates are infinite. I vow to enter them. The awakened way is unsurpassable. I vow to embody it. We say these every day. And we talk about them a lot in our community, but I went back and I checked. And I realized that though we reference them a lot, I haven't actually talked about them directly for a long time. So because there's so much in my mind and so much part of the flavor of what we're doing, I wanted to go back to the beginning. And I wanted to pick them apart in a way that I think I haven't done, and I think it's interesting. I don't usually like to get into the language side of it, or the, you know, picking apart Chinese characters. It's not everyone loves doing that, but I want to do it this time because it's worth it. When we chant these vows in Japan, "For beings are countless, I vow to free them all," we say, "Shujo muhen se gando." I want to break that down. Shujo means sentient beings. The shu in shujo actually means life. So there's an implication when we talk about sentient beings, that sentient beings refer to things that are alive, right? And that's the classic way to understand that. But Dogen is very clear in this tradition, so we can move from there. Dogen is very clear. When we say sentient beings, we mean everything. We aren't going to discriminate. We aren't going to put ourselves in the position of being the arbiter of what matters and what doesn't matter. We talked about this a few weeks ago when we asked, does the coronavirus have Buddha nature? This tradition doesn't demand of us that we know what is sentient and what is not. Everything is included. And so when we chant this, we don't say sentient beings. We just say beings. Shujo. And the next is muhen. And this, I think you might find interesting. The mu in muhen is, it's a negative pronoun. It means the absence of something. And it's weirdly well known in the Zen world, because we have this koan in which the teacher is asked, does a dog have Buddha nature? And the response is mu, which is at once very straightforward and very vague. So we all know this mu. Hen, from muhen, we say countless, or in some Zen centers and some Zen temples, in English I hear them say limitless, or not limitless, limitless. Hen actually refers to a boundary. So if we're being technical here, beings are countless is not so good. In fact, countless is more appropriate later when we talk about Dharma gates. That word that we use there speaks more to the idea of things being unquantifiable, without number. Muhen means that they're without boundary, which is beautiful. It's not about counting. It's not about the scale. It's about the intimacy. So I'll get back to that. Shujo muhen seigan. Seigan is the phrase that's repeated in all four. Seigan means the vow, or to take an oath. And do, at the end, this is a very specialized use of that character, because usually it's used to refer to, for example, the number of times you do something. It's not that interesting. But there's this one word, tokudo, which means ordination, and shukke tokudo, which means home-leaving ordination. Its inclusion in that term brings it into this other meaning, which we might most easily describe as saving, to save in a spiritual sense. Okay, so shujo, beings, muhen, without boundary, and that's modifying the beings. So beings without boundary, and then vow, and then save. It's worth noting, and I think I've pointed this out before, that the subject in this sentence is implied. So in every English iteration I've ever heard, we say, beings are countless, I vow to free them all. It's very personal. I'm going to do this. And there's this other group. There's me and there's them. And it's a very powerful story when we think of the Bodhisattva. Again, when we imagine the Bodhisattva saying, you first, you first, you first, it's such a lonely and heroic stance. We might imagine the Bodhisattva standing on a mountain, looking down at the valley of all beings and saying, I'm going to save you all. But that sense of heroism and that sense of distance, that sense of other, is not actually in the spirit of this. And I think how many times I've said this vow out loud and how many times I've spoken of it in a way that might encourage this kind of thinking, you know, where the music is playing, the Bodhisattva enters the frame to save the day. We could just as easily say, we. And so on Facebook today, when I posted about this, what I wrote was, beings are countless, we vow to save us all. There's nothing in this that says we can't conceive of this as a community, or that we can't conceive of this in concert with all beings simultaneously. Beings are without boundary. And so just like I read last week when I read from Angel Kyodo Williams' piece, there is an idea implicit in this vow that the saving can only happen for everyone or none. That my idea of being here while you are being there is false. And therefore, this basic narrative of the Bodhisattva, which is that the Bodhisattva has checked all the boxes, all the spiritual boxes, except for this one thing of saving everyone else, that's false. Because the Bodhisattva could never check those boxes unless everyone has checked those boxes. That when the Bodhisattva achieves something, everyone achieves it. The Bodhisattva's freedom is everyone's freedom, and everyone else's cage is the Bodhisattva's cage. There is no gap. I take a lot of strength from these vows. They encourage me and they motivate me. I think about them all the time, and they're a screensaver on my computer so that every time I stop working, that's what I see again. I can't get away from them, but I have to be careful. I have to be careful of the I, and I have to be careful of the them. When all of this started, by which I mean a few months ago when we went online and people started isolating and people started wearing masks and people started following protocols so that not only they could be safe, but so that everyone could be safe, I could feel, and probably you could feel, it's not just that you're following the rules and therefore you are saving all beings. It's that there are all these bodhisattvas out there who are saving you. You are always on the receiving side. Always. When I watch these last 2 weeks and I see the protests on television and I see the backlash to the protests, I see the harm that people are addressing and the harm that people are facing, I have both of these impulses. One, that I want so desperately to save them, and the other, the acknowledgement, the unmistakable recognition that they are saving me. Because there can't be a problem that someone else has independently. There cannot be suffering that is not everyone's. We can shield ourselves from that fact. We can hide from that fact. We can imagine that somehow we're above it or we're separate from it. But if someone else is trapped, according to this teaching, you are also trapped. And so any move toward freedom is a move toward freedom for all. Any move away from freedom is a move away from freedom for all. We have to really breathe this in. It should hurt a little bit. Not only at the realization of it, but because it points to wounds that we ignore. There are so many things that we try not to feel. There are so many problems that we try not to own. But beings are without boundary. All of them. That's you. It's everyone you've ever seen. That means there is no distance between you and them. None. Except the one that you create and uphold in your mind. And I say you, but I mean me. We do this so instinctively and so naturally that we can go our whole lives without noticing. I really want to change the way we say this vow. I'm going to be thinking about it. I think we might need the we. I think we might need to point to this idea of having no boundary. I think it challenges us more. There's a question here when we think about saving. Just as in the story, if you imagine walking away from Omalas, you have to ask yourself, even before you ask, what am I willing to give up? The question is, what do I think is mine? What have I decided is mine to keep? What do I think I'm entitled to? This one line, this one short line says, almost anything you've concluded about those questions is wrong. It's a beautiful vow. It's a powerful vow. And it should fill us with a kind of energy. But it should also leave us feeling raw and confused. For me, that's what Buddhism is like. I'll stop there.
You have been listening to a Thousand Harbors Zen podcast. Please visit thousandharborszen.com.